Some pointers or comments about Kinhin. So in the school that I come from, San Francisco Zen Center School, if you're doing Kinhin, the bell goes to end Zazen, you get up from your cushion, you massage your cushion or fluff it or whatever, reshape it, and then you stand up, you're ready for Kinhin. In other schools of Zen, you bow to your cushion and away from your cushion, and then you're ready for Kinhin. And at the end of Kinhin, you bow to your cushion and away from your cushion. And Zen Center decided, San Francisco Zen Center, decided to drop that just for simplifying the form, that if you're staying in the Zendo, there's no need to bow to and away from your cushion. So you just fluff your cushion, massage your cushion, do what you need to set it ready for when you come back, after Kinhin that is, and there's no need to bow to and away. Aware that there's different schools, but I just thought I would say this in case some of you want to do it this way. And then when the clappers go to end Kinhin, you just walk in the same circuit till you get to your seat, but at more or less a normal pace. Okay, I think we're doing great, by the way. I mean, there was a teacher when I was at Tassajara, his name was Daigon, not the Daigon that you know, a much older guy, he's now passed away, dead, gone. But he had a military background. I think he was in one of the American, I think he was in Korea. And he described Zen forms, the forms that we practice, as Zen crowd control. Right? Which, when we got this number of people, it really just seemed to be that crowd control. Another comment on Kinhin is the furthest row, that you're facing those Buddhas and the wall. Okay, so when you come back, when you finish Kinhin, ordinarily your cushions would be against the wall or to the wall, and you would bow with your back to your sitting cushion. But that's because your cushion would be against the wall. So if you would bow facing the way you are now, okay, the reason that your cushions are not against the wall is because of these two wonderful antique statues, which is why I didn't actually want people doing Kinhin behind them or too close to them, just in case we had an accident. And also there's quite a big step down if you're doing Kinhin through that area. I was afraid that there might be inviting some kind of accident. Okay, so that's the preamble. Dharma talk. When we did this retreat last year, or we did a retreat last year, had the Dharma talk, I think, around 4 o'clock or sometime in the afternoon, followed by a discussion. And looking at the schedule this time round, Laura said, we normally have our Dharma talk at 7:30 in the evening. And I thought, oh, okay, I can work with that. And I'll put in a class in the morning. And in the class in the morning, we can have our discussion. So having the Dharma talk in the evening, I thought, yeah, it'll be a little bit like a bedtime story. And then as the day went on and I saw where my mind was going, I was thinking, it's more like a bedtime story by the Brothers Grimm. There's a few strands of my thinking that I would like to try and weave together. together. So the line that really struck me yesterday and today, and I could probably say it, but I wouldn't be doing it word for word. Some of you can probably guess what it is because you know the way. I think you've been around long enough. Yeah. Such a casual and simple remark. After some years, we will die. That's it. I just wanted to look that up. After some years, we will die. So, some people die before they're 10 years old. Some people die in their teens. Some in their 20s, some in their 30s, some in their 40s, some in their 50s. And it goes all the way up to 100 and more. Okay. But no matter how long it is, it's still, we can say, after some years, we will die. And there's, as our technology is at the moment, there's no real getting around it. And this touches upon what would be one of the three messengers of the Pali Canon, or early Buddhism. The three messengers are old age, disease, and death. They're known as the three messengers, and they correspond to the first three sites of the Buddha to be. The prince, Siddhartha. He was living a life of luxury in his palace, and he became curious, and as you know, curiosity killed the cat, curiosity killed the prince. He got his attendant to bring him out, and in the first round he saw a diseased person, somebody suffering from disease, and he had never seen this before because the palace was carefully curated so that he wouldn't encounter suffering, curated by his father, the king. And we can really try and go into the psychology of a king who wants to protect his young son from all evidence of suffering. With the idea that I don't want him to go and take this spiritual guru path thing, so I better protect him from suffering. But then what kind of king could he be if he was completely naive about suffering? So I actually think that the king wanted him to go on the guru path, even though the Pali Canon says that he didn't, because by protecting him from suffering, he, assuming that the king was somewhat wise and mature and so forth, by protecting him from suffering, he would realize that sooner or later he's going to encounter it, and the later he encounters it, the bigger of an impact it will have. Right. So that would be my way of thinking. Okay. But it's easy in retrospect, right? Okay. And the bigger the impact it has, the more likely he is going to be to take this spiritual path. Okay. But the Pali Canon says the reverse, that the king did not want him to take the spiritual path, wanted him to be a successor to himself, and the prophecy at his birth was that he would either be a great king or a great spiritual leader. He said, well, I don't want him to be a great spiritual leader, I want him to be a great king, so I'll protect him from suffering. Doesn't add up in my mind. So he persuades his attendant to take him out of the palace, and the first trip he sees a diseased person, and he'd never seen this before, And he says, wow, what am I looking at here? And the attendant, his attendant, explains that this is a sick person and we are all prone to sickness, to loss of health. And so the young Buddha-to-be becomes disillusioned. And then curiosity again, he wants to go back out and he sees a very old person, somebody, say, decrepit with old age, and he'd never seen this before, so he asks the attendant and gets, this is an old person and we are all subject to old age. So this was the next disillusionment. And then on the third visit out, he sees a dead person, which he had never seen before. And I guess it's on a funeral pyre being taken to the burning grounds. And he asks the question, gets the answer, and again, he is greatly disillusioned because he had never thought of it. Okay. So after some years, we will die. This touches upon the three messengers, touches upon the first three sites. And we are all subject to the first three sites. And the fourth site, because there were four sites, it's kind of optional. It's where the Buddha is out and he sees what was at the time a wandering ascetic. Somebody doing various ascetic practices, living in forests or living on the edge of civilization. And there was something about this person that was so unusual, the Buddha-to-be remarked on it and asked his attendant for an explanation. The explanation, this is a wandering ascetic who is seeking liberation from the rounds of rebirth. Now, the rounds of rebirth must have been a new idea to this young prince. Pali Canon doesn't say this, but it must have been if he had never encountered the idea of death before. Right, so you can only have rebirth if you have death. So this wandering ascetic is seeking liberation from the rounds of rebirth. But as you probably know, if you spend a few days in meditation, or if you spend a few days doing a yoga retreat or a Tai Chi retreat, people may remark on it when you go back. They say there's something different about you. You take on a certain kind of glow, or at least you can do. And you might not notice it, but family members might. So this was the Buddha's inspiration. So the first three sites were his disillusionment. I mean, it's like, this is it? But then he saw this wandering mendicant or wandering ascetic and he thought, maybe this is the way. Maybe I can realize liberation from the rounds of rebirth. And then the story goes that he went off and he became a wandering ascetic, but he succeeded. He found the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha. Brilliant, great. And then he decided to teach this path. And the path is the Noble Eightfold Path. So I was asked a question in writing, and if anybody would like to put their hand up about the meaning of life. Thank you for your question. Is it okay if I answer it now? Or first answer, there can be a second and third answer. So if we look at dukkha, it is dissatisfaction. And basically, I was just thinking, so as my birthday was in January, and I got to think, no, the terms and conditions have just been updated. I'm now 1 year closer to death. So we're often getting these messages on my computer or on your phone, if you've got some kind of an account, your terms and conditions have been updated. Well, you didn't actually consult with me, you just updated them, okay. But my continued use of it means that I accept the new terms and conditions. So my continuing to live means that I accept the new terms and conditions, okay. But basically the terms and conditions, according to the first three sites, are unsatisfactory. They are dukkha. This is not a satisfactory deal, right? So that would be the gist of it. But there's a chance that on the fourth site, I can turn the table. And I can reach the cessation of dukkha. Now, what does life look like if you reach the cessation of dukkha? Well, the terms and conditions are no longer unsatisfactory. Bingo. That's what we're looking for. Right? So the idea is that we reach a freedom the freedom in the Pali Canon comes with insight into the seeing things as they really are. On that insight, seeing things as they really are, we experience a liberation. We simultaneously see through the illusion of self and are therefore liberated from the burden of self. Now, before we get to that point, what is it that gives life meaning? And before I started Buddhism, I was kind of primed for Buddhism by reading a few existentialist books, which basically say that life has no meaning. I mean, there's no meaning in the universe. There's no inherent meaning in it. And this is a problem because we are creatures or we are beings that want meaning. Okay. So before you reach the cessation of dukkha, the meaning or the purpose of life is to reach the cessation of dukkha. My thinking before I encountered Buddhism was that, well, it's really up to me, and whatever meaning I could come up with was kind of unsatisfactory because it would change, right? So this is impermanence. Or I was still disappointed, no matter how grand a future I could imagine for myself, it was still unsatisfying because it was not the grand vision of the universe, it was just the grand vision of little old me, right? And would die with me, or whatever. So I had decided, well, the best thing that I could do with my life was, you have to marvel at my lack of imagination. So the best thing that I could do with my life was become an engineer, right? But my saving grace, when I came across the Dharma, I realized that this was way more important, right? And the reason I decided that an engineer was the best thing that I could do with my life was that I had a passion for mathematics and physics, right? But as I say, when I came across the Dharma, when I started practicing for a little while, I thought, well, this is revolutionary. This really has the potential to turn things around. And because of my existentialist background, I could say, all things being equal, this one which promises to one, you can see things as they really are, and bring about the cessation of dissatisfaction as a result of it. It could be all bullshit, right? But of all the things that are out there, if I had to stake my life on something, it would be this. Because nothing else is going to be worthwhile, but this could be. Right? So I decided that in giving up everything else, I wasn't really giving up anything of intrinsic value. I mean, this is the perspective at the time, intrinsic value. And I was taking on something that could be a real jewel. Right? So I did. Yeah, there was some point I actually said to my first teacher, there's enough engineers in the world, but there's not enough Dharma teachers. Right? Sometimes, especially living at San Francisco Zen Center, I thought there are too many Dharma teachers, but that's beside the point. Well, we don't need teachers, we need practitioners. Right? And this is it. It's really getting to the heart of it. So how does this give life meaning? Well, the idea to me, thinking, is that meaning is the need for meaning is a form of dukkha. Right? And if you're able to bring about the cessation of dukkha, the Noble Eightfold Path, if you're able to see things as they really are, then you don't need meaning in order to live. Because you have seen the totality, and that is enough. But more so, you've seen the illusory nature of self. And that brings me into the two strands that I want to weave into this. So before enlightenment, the purpose of life, or the meaning, possibly, of life, this is up to each of you to decide, is to become enlightened or to experience the freedom that results from seeing things as they really are. Now, there's various teachers who have said different things on this. I don't know if any of you have practiced with the Deshu Maru lineage of Zen. Deshu Maru Roshi said, we do this practice so that we can die without fear. Katagiri Roshi, who was a contemporary to Suzuki Roshi, and lived, it's Maizumi, who practiced in L.A. around about the same time that Suzuki Roshi was practicing in San Francisco. Maizumi Roshi said, we do this practice so that we can appreciate our life. Yeah, it's a little bit like appreciating very good food or very good wine or very good chocolate or very good something. Like, you appreciate it. And that's, to be able to appreciate it is an art in itself. So we do this practice so that we can appreciate our life with all its twists and turns, nuances, and that our life is just as it is. just so. Now Suzuki Roshi said something like, we should appreciate this limited life. You know, I can't do all the things that I would want to do. No, I can't do all the things that I do want to do, not that I would want to do, I do want to do. And my life is limited. But to appreciate that limited life, it's like the poet Patrick Kavanagh says, through a chink too wide, there comes in no wonder. And Norman Fisher, my teacher, said, we do this practice so that we can become an ordinary, decent human being. And you thought, well, I already am that. Yeah, that's true. But so that we can stay an ordinary, decent human being or become even more ordinary. There's a saying that I picked up in Aikido, on the dojo wall, and I think it was attributed to the founder. His name I can barely pronounce, Ueshiba. It says, when confused, go back to basics. Right? So I sometimes do this in my thinking, like I get these ideas that I could be doing something else, you know, I could give up this teaching gig and maybe just become an electrician again and live a simple life. It's the appeal of living a simple life, okay. But I go back to basics. Why am I doing this? What could reverting or going back to being an electrician do that this can't do? And I ask myself, would I still sit? I said, yeah, of course, I'd still sit. And then I'd say, well, would I want other people to sit with me? I say, yeah. Okay, so why go back? Why give it up? Right. Okay. So these are just little fantasies that I have from time to time. Another fantasy that I may yet do is give up being a Zen monk and become a Theravadan monk. And this fantasy is very much encouraged by the fact that I could become a Theravadan monk for 3 months. It's not necessarily a lifetime commitment. I sometimes think that all I really want to do is sit and I could just disappear and hide and sit in a Theravadan monastery. So, the Buddha would be going around teaching and he would get this kind of fantasy. He would think, oh, I could go back and be the king that my dad wanted me to be. And I could rule with wisdom and compassion. And then he would say, no. This is the last birth. There is no more renewal of this to come. So this is one of the themes that play around in my mind. I decided to sit with it. This is my last birth. And how does that change things? So this is a kind of thought experiment. There's something decisive about it, there's something conclusive about it, there's something, it enables him to continue on the path that he is on and that he chose decades ago or just years ago. This is the last birth. So if this is your last birth in a really long chain of births, How do you want to spend it? What do you want to do with it? Now, the same logic can apply. This is my only birth, right? As seems to fit with modern thinking, more so than rebirth. This is my only birth. So if this is your only life, in my existentialist hat or mode, what do you want to do with it? But there's something about this is the last one, right? This is the last one. So I translate it. I say to myself, this is the last decade. What do I want to do with it? And then I try the, was it Stephen Levine? This is the last year. How does that change your perspective? So what I've found is that it's much easier to let go of whatever desire may be manifesting at the time. And it makes it much easier to stay on the path that I'm on. This is the last. Okay. So there's another part. This is the last birth. There is no more. Now I've got two lines in memory. There is no more of this to come. That's one. Or there is no more of this renewal of being to come. And going off on another career is a renewal of being or a renewal of becoming. So he's talking about bringing that cycle to a stop. And this is, it's meaningful in the sense that it's something that the question is vital. There's a great line in one of the chants. It says, the meaning is not in the words, or it's not in the question. The meaning is not in the words, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. And that's where the Zen koans come in. The inquiring impulse. What is it? I mean, what is the... Take it as you will. What is it? Or how can I see things as they really are? And that can shrink down into seeing things as they really are. Things as they really are. Reality. What is reality? Okay. So the meaning is not in the words, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. Or it responds to the question. So we have koans, and we ask ourselves questions. And if we stay with the same question, it provokes a chain of answers from within ourselves, and we keep at it until we get to the bottom line, till we get to the truth. So this is the last birth. There is no more of this renewal of being. So running that is one of the strands. Another one is, I'm looking at the time. Okay, this may be to be continued tomorrow, perhaps. Okay, the bedtime story that goes on and on and on and on. Never-ending bedtime story. The other strand that I've been churning over is, to free all beings. It's one of the, I think it's one of the vows, to live in enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, but it's the bodhisattva idea of to free all beings. Now there's a very important clue to understanding this in such a way that it as the possibility of making sense. Because the idea of actually freeing all beings one after the other, or how do you free them en masse, that's a little bit daunting. But I found out that the original translation in San Francisco Zen Center said, and it could have been a typo, but I don't think so, to free all being. And all being is the existence as a whole. So it's the absolute. So now the question is, I'm not trying to free all beings, individuals. I'm trying to free or release the absolute. So the absolute is imprisoned by our fixation with the relative, or what other people would say are dualistic thinking. So finding meaning, we can find it in the literature and find it in, we have to find an inspiration, something to live for, something to move towards, something that we want to manifest. We find meaning. Meaning is not something outside that is, say, here, this is your meaning. Robert Thurman, I heard a recording of one of his lectures, and I just remember the start of it. He said, and I hope I'm not offending anybody with this, it certainly isn't meant as an offense, but he said, theism is the belief that that which has value is outside yourself. Now, obviously that's negotiable or debatable, right? But I was taken by it. I thought, oh, because Buddhism keeps saying to look within. Christianity does too. I mean, Jesus did too. Look within. The answer is within. And the meaning is what you respond to. You may be inspired by these Zen forms, Soto Zen forms, or you may not. You may have done a Theravadin retreat or an insight retreat and thought, that was much better. And that's okay. Whatever floats your Dharma boat. And that's one of the great things about being in the West. There's such a variety of forms of the Dharma. Can also be a downside too, because we've got so much shopping around to do before we settle somewhere. Yeah. So to free all being. Now I'm playing with this, right? It's kind of, what does it really mean? I'm trying to get to the, trying to resolve it, right? To free all beings, to free all being. And in the process of resolving it, I feel as though I'm like, incrementally, that's not even the right word, so ephemerally or something, moving closer to some kind of resolution of it. And this is the essence of koan practice, that you have a question and the question grips you, and that question is the meaning of your life. That is the question that you want to pour your life's energy into, and as you do it, it reveals more and more about yourself. More and more about reality. So I gave the quotes from a few Dharma teachers as to what they said, why we do this practice. But my favorite, I think, well, my favorite changes. Yeah. San Francisco Zen Center, we have a meal chant before we eat. And in part of it we say, we eat to support life, that makes sense, and to practice the way of Buddha. So that's at least suggesting that the meaning or purpose of our life is to practice the way of Buddha. Okay, to be continued. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.